So we were talking about chirality last time, using drugs as an example. I talked about this already in slide 8. Just remember that you can't say that the left-handed version is always right or the right-handed version is always right. It just depends. It's on a case-by-case basis. It depends on what the receptor is that's in the body. If there's a right-handed receptor, then only the right-handed signal is going to work. And these two examples show you that. That's using the S and R standard. Remember I said that S is sinistro, that means left, and R is recto. In 9, we see another example. L-DOPA and D-DOPA. L-DOPA is the stuff that works in your body, the left-handed version. But this uses another standard. It's not always R and S. It can be L and D. Levo and dextro, left and right. But just another example. These are chiral compounds. So that brings us to 10. And in 10, we have structural formulae for estrogen and testosterone, which are just two of the several steroid hormones that animals like you use. And I probably don't have to tell you that estrogen and testosterone have quite different effects on the body. One is feminizing, one is masculizing. So very different in how they, in what they cause in the body. But when you look at the structural formula, you can see that they are very similar chemicals. The structure is largely the same. As a matter of fact, both of these things are produced out of the same molecule that's just slightly modified into one or the other. Does anyone know what that molecule is that it starts out as? That animals cannot live without? No, it looks basically the same as this, and it's called cholesterol. Cholesterol is the precursor for all steroid hormones. It all starts out as cholesterol and gets very slightly modified. The only difference between these two hormones is what's shown in the bluish shading. The rest of the molecule is the same in both, right? And those bluish shadings are functional groups. They're examples of functional groups, which is really what the rest of this chapter is about. And we're almost done, so it's probably a short lecture today. Functional groups, first of all, are not molecules. They are not complete molecules. Functional groups are just fairly small collections of atoms arranged in a certain way, but that are part of an overall larger molecule. Just like you see in the blue shading. Go ahead. Oh, just cracking your neck? The reason that functional groups are called functional groups is because whether they are present in a molecule or not determines whether that molecule is going to have some sort of function. In other words, functional groups are just subsets of molecules that give that molecule a certain function. And you just barely got introduced to functional groups in lab this week, right? So I hadn't lectured about them yet. So now I will go over specific functional groups. Let's go to slide 11. Slide 11 and 12 are all one table, if you got this from a book. But anyway, slide 11 starts the table. And if this were an organic chemistry course, you would learn about more functional groups than what are going to be presented here. These are the biggies, though, as far as biology is concerned. And so these are the only functional groups that you'll need to know for this course. The table is arranged so that you can see the name at the top of the functional group, You also have a representation of it in two different ways, a ball and stick model and a structural formula model. And there's an example of each one and a description of why they're biologically important. So let's go through these column by column, starting with the first functional group listed, which is the hydroxyl group. Now, what I'm about to say is actually true of all, not just the hydroxyl. Notice that when you look at the structural formula, as it's drawn here, that the functional group, you can tell by the structural formula that it's not a molecule. How do you know that it's not a molecule? It's not complete with respect to bonding, right? The ball and stick just has a stick hanging off. It's not connected to anything. The structural formula has a dash representing a bond, but there's nothing on the other end of the bond. So that should tell you that a functional group is not a complete molecule. By the way, the structural formula can be written either of two ways, like they're doing it here with just the bond sticking off and nothing written at the other end. Or for hydroxyl, for instance, it could be OH with an R at the other end of the bond.
And R normally means the rest of the molecule.
R stands for residue, which means leftover, meaning the rest of the molecule, correct? So R is whatever collection of atoms that functional group is connected to make up the whole molecule. All right. And without R, whatever R is, it can be different in each molecule. Without R there, you don't have a complete molecule. Functional group is just part of the molecule. And by the way, where you write the R on which side does not matter. For instance, I could write this also as HO-R. Right? Just like you could turn a model around, a ball and stick model. I could not, though, write this as OH-R. What's wrong with this? That's right. Why can't it be connected to the hydrogen, the R? Because hydrogen has a valence of one and can make only one bond. It's already making a bond with oxygen. It has only one hole in the ball, right? So you couldn't possibly build this.
And it also means that oxygen is missing a bond.
That's right. Well, oxygen has to make two. It can't make two with this hydrogen, so this can't be a double bond. It would have an empty hole in the ball and stick model, and you wouldn't have enough holes in the hydrogen to do it. So this is wrong. This way is just a flipped around version of the top. They're equivalent. Okay, but now about the specifics of the hydroxyl. You find hydroxyls in a lot of organic compounds, including the ones you built in lab last time. It's a very simple functional group, which is why you see it pretty often. If a compound includes a hydroxyl group, then that defines that molecule, whatever it is, as an alcohol. Alcohol is not a single substance. Alcohols is a category of substances. Anything that includes an OH is an alcohol. Notice, by the way, if we temporarily go back to 10, estradiol gets its name because the OL ending means alcohol, and it's an alcohol because it has this OH there. Go ahead.
What's the difference between estradiol and estrogen?
Estrogen is a category that includes estradiol. Estradiol is a specific estrogen. So that's the naming convention is convenient. Like before, I was talking about the fact that all alkanes have names that end in A-N-E to remind you that it's an alkane, like methane, ethane, propane, and so on. Well, all alcohols have a name that end in O-L. To tell you that it's an alcohol. When we say alcohol in daily life, usually we're referring specifically to ethanol, which is the only beverage alcohol. Doesn't matter whether you're drinking beer, wine, or booze, it's all exactly the same alcohol. But there are countless other alcohols in the world. Ethanol, by the way, which is the one shown here, and the one you built, is called that because if instead of the hydroxyl you just had a hydrogen here, that would be ethane, the two-carbon alkane, right? So ethanol as a name means ethane-like alcohol with a hydroxyl instead of a single hydrogen. The fact that the hydroxyl includes an oxygen and a hydrogen means that alcohols are partially polar, right? Just like an OH in water makes water polar because, well, why is that? Why is it that an OH bond is polar? Right. The value for electronegativity of oxygen is substantially higher than the value for electronegativity of hydrogen. Oxygen is therefore more greedy when it comes to sharing the pair of electrons in the bond, and therefore those electrons spend more time around the oxygen than the hydrogen, giving the oxygen end of the bond slight negativity and giving the hydrogen end of the bond slight positivity. That's polarity. So polarity, we've talked about the importance of that in terms of water, but water's not the only thing that's polar. There's all kinds of alcohols in biology, though, because monosaccharides, which are the primary fuels in all organisms, are alcohols. Glucose that you built, that was an alcohol as well, right? Because it had hydroxyls in it. It's actually a multiple alcohol. The next up is carbonyl. And this one's a little different from the others in the list, most of which we haven't gotten to yet. But you can see that right away in the ball and stick and structural formula models. The difference here compared to hydroxyl and the others is that the carbonyl group has two unfinished bonds, two sticks hanging off of the ball and stick model, meaning that there's two R groups. You know, you could write this just like this structural formula with two R's, two places where it has to connect to something else. And therefore, because of that, there's two categories of things that contain carbonyl. I'll get into that in a second. First, though, let's review the actual structure. For the functional group to be carbonyl, it has to have exactly that structure. So it's a carbon atom. And that carbon atom is therefore simultaneously a member of the functional group and a member of the carbon skeleton of the overall molecule, right? The overall organic compound has a carbon structure, like a carbon skeleton, like we talked about last time. Well, this carbon is part of the carbon skeleton, but it's also part of the functional group. That carbon is then double bonded to an oxygen, which of course satisfies oxygen's valence. Carbon has a valence of 4, though. That's why it has to make two other bonds. Okay, now, I just said that there's two categories of substances that contain carbonyl. The reason that there's two categories is that because of these two R groups that the functional group has, there's two ways that you can find this in the carbon skeleton. One way is for the carbon that's part of the functional group to be at a tip of the carbon skeleton. Remember we talked about linear carbon skeletons and branched ones? If you have a linear carbon skeleton, then there's two tips. Each end is a tip. If you have one branch, you have three tips. More and more branches, you have all kinds of tips. But a tip is somewhere, just like the word tells you, somewhere at the end of the skeleton. Or at an end, could have more than one end. That's one possibility. And if that's true, then one of these R groups would simply be a hydrogen. Like you see right here in propanol. Okay? The other possibility, though, is that the carbon that's part of the carbonyl functional group is not at a tip. It's somewhere other than the tip of the skeleton, which you see in the example above that, which is acetone. See, this carbon is not at a tip. The tips are right here. This one is at a tip. It could be at either end. It's at this tip, though. Okay? Those are the two basic possibilities. And therefore, those two possibilities define two different categories. And we give two different names to those categories. Categories of substances. If the carbon is not at a tip, somewhere other than the end, then the category is called ketones. Ketones is not a single substance, it's a category. So there's many ketones. And if it is at a tip, then we call those substances that have it as a tip aldehydes. So in case you can't see those words, they are spelled thus. Whoops. For a long time, I couldn't. I always got these mixed up. Couldn't remember which one was which. And then one day, it dawned on me that the word ketone. Well, let's say aldehyde first. The word aldehyde starts with an A, which is at one tip of the alphabet. And ketone starts with a K, which is not at the tip of the alphabet. So the group that, I mean, the substances that where the carbonyl group is not at a tip are the ketones. And ketones have name, individual ketones, examples of ketones, have names to remind you that they're ketones ending in O-N-E, like acetone. Okay? Aldehydes have names that end in A-L to remind you that they're aldehydes, like propanol. Propanol and propanol are two different things, right? Propanol ending in an O-L is an alcohol. Propanol is an aldehyde. So the names are important. They're important reminders. Well, you also, just like you have hydroxyls in monosaccharides, as well as other things, you also have carbonyl groups in monosaccharides. When you built your glucose, it had a double. It had a carbonyl, right? You formed that pair of springs to make the carbonyl. So monosaccharides are also either aldehydes or ketones depending on the individual monosaccharide. And that alone is important in biology. But there's other reasons as well. Let's go on though to the next structure, which is the carboxyl group. And this one is confusing at first, because when you look at the structure, which is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen, and then that same carbon is also bonded to an OH, it looks like you really have two functional groups here, right? It looks like it's a carbonyl, and it looks like it's a hydroxyl. And technically it is. A hydroxyl and a carbonyl combined. But we don't consider it to be either of those when they are in this exact arrangement. Not separated from each other, but hooked together like that. It's not a carbonyl, it's not a hydroxyl. It's one functional group called carboxyl. But notice that they chose the name carboxyl to indicate that it's really a combination of a carbonyl and a hydroxyl. Well, the X comes from hydroxyl.
I know, that's the only change they did.
Well, they took out the N of carbonyl.
Place with the X of hydroxyl.
Oh, they took out hydro, though, too, as well.
Yeah.
But it's a portmanteau, which is a combination of two words into one.
Yeah.
Carboxyl. So don't consider that to, you know, if you are trying to identify functional groups on a structural formula, if you see that arrangement, don't say it has a hydroxyl. Don't say it has a carbonyl. It has a carboxyl, and that's it. If a substance or substances that include a carboxyl group, at least one carboxyl group, are classified as either carboxylic acids, that's the name of the category, self-explanatory. Well, the carboxylic part is explanatory. It gives them an acidic property as well because of that hydrogen that can be lost from the hydroxyl when you put it into water. That's what makes it acidic. So they're called either carboxylic acids, which is the more descriptive term, or sometimes they're called organic acids. The reason, by the way, that organic acids was chosen as a phrase is because a lot of times acids, typical acids like hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid, don't contain any carbon, and therefore they are not organic. Carboxylic acids, by definition, have to have carbon in them, so they're organic acids. Okay, so acetic acid, which is what acetic means vinegar, by the way. That's what gives vinegar its distinctive smell. That's acidic. There's multiple reasons why the carboxyl group is important, but one really, really important reason is that every subunit or monomer that a protein is made out of, I keep mentioning the importance of proteins, right? Can't have life without them. Proteins are large polymers, meaning they're you build them by hooking together a bunch of subunits called monomers. Every monomer of every protein has a carboxyl group. Those monomers, as we'll discuss much more after this first test, are called amino acids. And every amino acid has a carboxyl group in it, or it's not an amino acid and therefore can't be part of a protein. So that is a very important function of carboxyl group as far as biology is concerned. When we go to the next column, which is in slide 12, we see the amino group. Now, amino, the word tells you that there's nitrogen involved. When you see amino, amine, A-M-I-N as a combining form, you see variations of that in a lot of words in chemistry. That means nitrogen is part of whatever they're talking about. So you can see that the amino group is a nitrogen bonded singly to two different hydrogens. That makes up the functional group. And then the nitrogen, of course, has a valence of 3, so it has to be bonded to the rest of the molecule, the residue, or the R group. Well, I just got done telling you about the importance of the carboxyl group. Same thing is true for the amino group. I told you that the names of the subunits that make up proteins are called amino acids. Well, they're called amino acids because every one of them has an amino group. That's where the amino part of amino acid comes from. But also every amino acid has a carboxyl group, like I was saying before. That makes it a carboxylic acid. So amino acid is why these things were called that. And unless you have both of these things, not only do you not have an amino acid, but you can't hook them together to make a protein. So no life without either of these two functional groups. Next one is the sulfhydryl group. And this one is most similar to which other one that we've already discussed. The hydroxyl group. It's just like a hydroxyl, except instead of having oxygen, it has sulfur. Why does that chemically make sense, by the way?
Sulfur is directly below in the same column.
Same group.
Same group, thank you.
Yes.
Same group of
elements.
Elements.
That's right. Just below O is S. Sulfur has the same, similar properties compared to oxygen because it's in the same group, including the same valence, right? Which is why in lab, when you needed to substitute one of your colors for sulfur, it wasn't a random choice. You had to use oxygen. It had to have two holes, right? So you used the red one, if you did it correctly. Well, that's why it forms the same way as hydroxyl. Now, an OH, a true hydroxyl, being in a substance, makes that substance what? What do we call it as a category? No. A hydroxyl, if it has a hydroxyl, what kind of substance is it? What category? Yeah. It's an alcohol. This is not a hydroxyl. It's a sulfhydryl. Sulf obviously coming from the word sulfur. But notice that the name of the compounds, the category, is thiols. Thio means sulfur. So you see that as a combining form in a lot of words as well. Wherever you see thio, there's sulfur involved somehow. And notice the word thiol ends in O-L as though it were an alcohol. But it literally means sulfur alcohol. It's not truly an alcohol, but has similar properties because you're substituting sulfur for oxygen. So that those are thiols. And biologically, these are important, also involving proteins. Proteins are made up of amino acids, as I've said. You can use any of several different amino acids to make up each bead in the necklace that you're building, which is kind of what a protein is like. Some of these, including this one shown here, cysteine, includes a sulfhydryl. This is an amino acid. By the way, notice it has its carboxyl group. That's the acid part. Notice it has an amino group. That's the amino part. It's amino acid. So this one, though, happens to have sulfhydryl hanging off of it as well. And if you have a long chain of amino acids, your protein, and one of the amino acids here has a sulfhydryl and one of them over here has a sulfhydryl, and you bend the thing, like just bending a necklace, to get these two things together, the sulfhydryls in each of them will react chemically. They'll lose the hydrogen. Each sulfhydryl will lose a hydrogen, allowing the two sulfurs to covalently bond. And that locks it into that shape. And shape is everything for proteins. Proteins have their functions because of their specific shapes. And these disulfide bridges, as they're called, when this happens, stabilizes the shape a lot. And next one is methyl, which is found in many, many compounds. You have a lot of methyls because basically, if you just have to complete the valence of the molecule, if you have to satisfy the last carbon that's at a tip, the easiest way to do it is just to fill it up with hydrogens. That's what a methyl is. A terminal carbon at one tip or another, filled up with hydrogens to satisfy its valence. So it's CH3 with the C also then bonded to the residue. And not only are they found often, but they're important for various reasons, including... I skipped phosphate, so sorry about that. So we're out of order, but I'll get back to phosphate. One reason that methyl is important is that it allows for what is called methylation. Methylation simply means adding a methyl onto something to methylate it. And this is one way in which DNA can be controlled. DNA, which we'll study a lot eventually, can either be read as a code or it can be left alone. Well, one way of keeping it from being read, in other words, to turn a gene off, is to methylate it so that the molecular machinery that is responsible for reading a gene can't get in there and read it. So you can turn off sections of DNA by methylation. Let's go back to phosphate. I totally skipped over that. It's the most complex of the ones as far as the number of atoms. But it's phosphate because it's the phos part of the word refers to the fact that it includes a phosphorus atom. Notice that central phosphorus is connected to four oxygens, one of which is then, one of those oxygen then is connected to the residue. Also notice that two of those oxygens are actually ionized. They could be OH, it depends on the actual pH. They could be OHs, but if they lose that proton to solution, then they become O negatives. Just the electron is there, no longer the proton. Now, none of these functional groups is unimportant. They're all very important for various reasons. But phosphate has a long list of reasons why it is absolutely indispensable to life. One of which, and we call them organic phosphates, by the way, if they include phosphate. One of the reasons, though, is that you cannot possibly have DNA without phosphate. So no life without DNA, obviously, right? And that's because DNA, like protein, is also a polymer. It's built out of subunits. The subunits are not amino acids. They're nucleotides. But every single nucleotide, in order to be a nucleotide, has to have a phosphate. And so every stretch of DNA, which is millions of nucleotides long, has millions of phosphates in it. No possibility of DNA or, for that matter, RNA, the other informational molecule in life, without phosphate. So that reason alone is vitally important. It's also true, though, that you can't, without phosphate, you can't have ATP, which you may have heard about. ATP is an important energy-carrying molecule in all organisms. And so the reason that you're able to stay alive minute to minute is largely because of because of ATP working. And that's a special molecule that we'll study in detail later as well. Still another really important function of phosphate is that certain proteins, and this includes a lot of enzymes. Enzymes are specific proteins. Can be either phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. I was talking about methylation, adding a methyl to a group. You can also have phosphorylation, adding a phosphate to a molecule. And dephosphorylation is removal of it. Well, phosphorylation and dephosphorylation is an important control mechanism. It serves more or less as an on-off switch. So an enzyme can be there the whole time, but not operating unless it's either phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. It's like turning it on and off. You only want it to work when it's appropriate for the circumstances. And so you can keep it around, but just switch it on as necessary and switch it off when necessary. That's because of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. All right. Those are the ones that you have to know for this course. And so I think this is the final slide, 13. This just shows you ATP that I just talked about. So we'll study this in much more detail later, but you can see that ATP, which stands for adenosine triphosphate, has not only a phosphate, it happens to have three phosphates. This reminds me, by the way, of something to be careful about. The shorthand notation in books for the phosphate group is P with a circle around it. Just be careful with that. A P with a circle around it does not mean a phosphorus atom. A P just by itself means a phosphorus atom. If you have that circle around it, that's just shorthand for, yes, you have the phosphorus atom there, but you also have those four oxygen atoms to make the phosphate group. And the reason this ATP molecule serves as an important energy-carrying molecule is because the bonds between adjacent phosphates store a lot of chemical energy. So when you have ATP, it's carrying a lot of energy. It's not doing anything for you until you release it to do something that requires energy in the cell, and you release it by cleaving off the last phosphate. That turns it into ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And so notice now you have what's called an inorganic phosphate because it's no longer connected to any carbon. It's just a phosphate group on its own in solution. But the energy that was in this bond has been released and can do some work in the cell. This is a reversible reaction. It's not shown that way, but you can force this to go backwards. And that's what you do after you have eaten, digested your food, sent that digested material to the cells of the body, and then it starts using it as fuel. The energy that it gets out of the bonds of the molecules that used to be in your food go into reversing this and investing that energy into ATP by taking an inorganic phosphate and putting it on to ADP to make it back into ATP. So it's always going back and forth, but we'll talk about the particulars of that in a different unit. And that means we're done for the unit. So just let me remind you. Is it remind? I can't remember whether I told you this to begin with. For the test, which is the next time you show up, you need to have a Scantron form. Did I talk about that? Oh, sorry. Astraea used to give them to you. They've cheapened up in recent years, so they forced you to buy your own. It's not a life-changing expenditure because it's just little pieces of paper. But you have to go to the bother of getting your own from the bookstore on campus. And I think they sell them in packets of six, which is just about perfect for this course. There are different forms. Yes, for some people. There are different Scantron versions. So tell them you need the green one that has 50 questions. They're about this long, this wide, and they're greenish, not the brown ones. But one packet of them will be enough for this course. Just don't forget to bring them, though, because Astraea doesn't give them to me either. So I'm not going to have any for those of you who do forget. Hopefully it'll be zero, but usually there's at least one person who forgets, which means you're just going to have to try to bum one from one of your classmates during a stressful test situation. So it's better to just have your own on hand. Yeah.
So you said buy a 50-pack of those.
No, not a 50-pack. A pack has six of the minimum. A little cellophane pack has six forms, which is enough for the course. But each individual form has 50 question spaces.
So buy one pack of the Scantron green...
50, yeah, green 50-question Scantron forms.
Is it? You said it's like a packet, so it's like an actual like item?
There's six individual forms in it. It's just a strip of paper. But they package them six to a cellophane packet.
How do you spell it?
S-C-A-N-T-R-O-N.
T-R-O-N.
That's just a brand name, Scantron.
Oh,